Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Welcome on to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we're talking to Brett Richards, who is the CEO and director of Goldshore, who are a TSXV listed company and also on the OTC. It's Goldshore Resources is the full name of the company. So welcome, Brett. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
No, it's good to be talking to you. And Kenny, of course, how are you doing?
Yep, all good. Excellent, Brett, to have you on. We spoke a few weeks ago, and this was one I was looking forward to because it was certainly an interesting call we had a few weeks ago. And I know you're very passionate about gold, and obviously with the situation in the world at the moment, gold's pushing back up towards its sort of 2000 level again. So we can come on to that in, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes. But where are you actually calling us from, Brett? Today, what part of Canada?
I'm in the original part of Canada called London. I'm in England this week doing some marketing, and yeah, I'll be here all week.
All right, excellent. Yep, and obviously Mark's in Holland, and I'm up in Scotland, so a good spread.
Maybe Brett, you want to start us off by talking a little bit about your background, where you've come from, and your past career. Just give us a bit of a introduction to Brett and where you how it's led to you going to Goldshore.
Just to kind of go back into, you know, how I ended up kind of where I am today. I've kind of been in the, let's call it, the heavy industrial space for almost 36 years now. I did an engineering degree, and I was in the steel business for about 15 years. And one of the assets that we held was actually over here in England on the Isle of Sheppey. It was called Sheerness Steel. And we had four other steel mills in North America, in Canada and the US. And we were a fairly large listed company, Toronto, fairly large. I think it was $1.5 billion at one time. And really kind of went through kind of the operations management all the way up to becoming senior executive in the organization, working for a CEO. We ended up doing a transaction to sell the company to a Brazilian company. And the irony is, I did my MBA down at Cornell, and my partner in it was the son of the founder of Gerdau. And we ended up doing our MBA thesis on doing a transaction together. And lo and behold, 1 year later, we did. And so a bit of irony there. But one of my directors at the time, I had three very, very influential mining directors on my board. And one was Ian Delaney, who was CEO and chairman of Sherritt, and Dr. Michael Sopko, who was the head of Inco, and Bob Buchan, who was the head of Kinross. And when we had ultimately, put this transaction together, I joined Kinross and spent several years, you know, on assets in Russia and several years in South America and North America. And in 2005, the COO of Kinross retired, Art Ditto, and Art and Bob and myself and another gentleman, we formed a company that was called Katanga Mining. And we went to the market and raised initial seed capital, and then we went to project financing straight away and put together $250 million of syndicated debt and $250 million of equity, and away we went. And I spent the next kind of 3.5 years in the DRC, in the Katanga province, you know, working on the project and putting it all together. And Katanga was a very big success story, and I got a lot of investors into it who made a lot of money. Early stage investors did 86 times money. There were others who did kind of very well as well. And, you know, and management did very well indeed. But coming out of that project, we actually merged with Glencore in 2009, and I left and I went and ran another gold company in London called Avocet. Yep. took it from a couple hundred million dollars to $1.2 billion before I left. And my vision at Avocet was really to build a West African, you know, powerhouse, much like what Endeavor has built. And we had attempted to do a number of transactions, and I think we had some strong resistance from a couple of people on my board. And I think I just ended up saying, you know, life is too short to continue to not be aligned in strategy and be confrontational with people on your board who should be, you know, supporting strategy. They really wanted to set the strategy, and I just don't think that's appropriate. So long story short is I just didn't want to run a company that had a single mine in West Africa. So, you know, single asset risk was quite high, especially in that jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So I went on and I ran a proxy battle for the Sprott organization to restructure Rocks Gold. And then I started working for private equity companies because, you know, a lot of people who I'd made a lot of money over the years, a lot of institutional investors that were resource focused, they wanted to, you know, they wanted my expertise. They wanted my team. At one point I had, you know, almost 40 guys working for me on various projects for private equity. But I think stepping back now and looking at the projects that we did, I can see where there were some obvious opportunities that my clients had got into. They got into distress and they failed. And then I had to take them out of distress or take them through a restructuring, either financial or operational. And those situations they're difficult. But I think when I look at them, I learn from kind of those failures. Why did they go wrong? These were decent assets. And why did they go so wrong? And you know, although it was difficult to find the path through to making them successful, I often look back and say and learn from what had gone wrong at the end of the day. So you know, most recently I've probably been in Africa for probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, and had 3 or 4 projects going on simultaneously. And you know, one of my guys who works for me has for many, many years is Pete Flindell, who I brought onto this project. And Pete is also, you know, he's around my age and he's got 35 years of experience in mineral exploration and feasibility studies. And he's very, very good at what he does. He's a very good geologist. And we both cut our teeth with majors. Me at Kinross and Pete spent 12 years at Newmont. And we understand how the mining sector works. We understand what majors want, but we also understand how juniors provide that pipeline, how they raise capital, how they provide that pipeline of projects, good projects, some not so good, but some good, and how for every 10 projects, only a couple of them make it to the next level, and a couple of those out of 5 probably make it to a, you know, feasibility study. And so he's quite dialed in to, you know, approaching this project, Gold Shore and the Moss Lake Gold Project, approaching it like it's going to go into production one day, because we both believe it's going to. We have 4 million ounces of historical resource. And our job is to try and, you know, make this a tier one asset and a tier one asset in Ontario. And by definition, that's about a 10 million ounce resource, 10-year life of mine, big production profile, north of 500,000 ounces per year, and kind of lower half of the cost curve. So we got involved in this financially. We got involved in this operationally by running it. I put together the first $25 million last year. We put together another $10 million in November, and we're kind of well into our drilling program, which is going to go on for the entire part of this year. And that's going to define this deposit. You know, I'm pretty confident it's going to define it as a tier one asset. And then we'll look to where do we go from there? Do we try to make it bigger? Do we look for a partnership? Do we look for an off-ramp for our shareholders, et cetera? There's a number of ways that we can look at this. And again, you mentioned the point about, you know, learning from failures. I think a lot of junior mining companies fail because management, they can't really understand that they have a role. My role here is a 2 years, 3 years, maybe. And I need to get out of the way so that those who have the balance sheet, the financial capacity, the big project teams, the big construction teams, the big operations teams, they can partner with us and they can take this to the next level. And junior miners, certainly CEOs, they don't want to give up their lifestyle. And, you know, this is not a lifestyle for me. I'm doing this to make money, but I'm not doing this because I need a job or Pete needs a job. Neither one of us need a job. We're just trying to make money, and we're trying to make money for our shareholders. And when the time comes to get out of the way of this, you know, I'm going to welcome it, and I'm going to, I will be the Teflon that helps, you know, pave the way for somebody to come in and make this very seamless. And by doing this to a standard that we understand, working for majors in our career, by understanding what majors want, we're going to do this the right way. And that's where I think junior mining CEOs fail. They don't get out of the way. They don't consolidate. They don't want to lose their job per se. So I think that's how we approach this very differently. We approach this that we're going to create value in a shorter period of time as possible. And then we're going to kind of move aside and we're going to find the right partner for our shareholders and the right partner for the project and help facilitate something, whatever that something is. And I can't speculate what that is. It could be anywhere from a complete takeout to a partial takeout to a, you know, involvement in some way, shape, or form. It's whatever will be best suited at that time.
Yep. Excellent. I'll let you come in a minute, Mark, because I know I've been talking about it, but obviously it'd be interesting to find out how you have this love of gold. You know, this is your the only commodity being, the only safe haven, etc. When did this start or how did it come about? Obviously, you've worked a lot of companies that have obviously been exploring and producing gold. So obviously that's a big factor, but there must be some other sort of thesis behind it. And I know, Mark, you're very interested in this. So I'll probably let you step in with Brett at this point as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, of course, gold, well it was over 2000, just maybe an hour or two ago. Now it's back at about 1970. Yeah. It's a risk off at time, I would suggest, with the dollar being up as well. Would you agree, Brett, for now anyway?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think with what's going on, yeah, we did see it just touch over 2000 this morning and pull back. But again, headline driven, and there is a lot of risk off. And now with the situation in the Ukraine, there being a little bit of relief on letting some of the refugees leave, you know, the gold prices, you know, reacted to that. And, you know, as crazy as that sounds, I think a lot of this is headline driven, but a lot of the institutions I've been talking to over the last week and met with last week in Vancouver, I'm concerned about this and everyone's concerned about this, but, you know, what it's going to do to the capital markets this morning when they open up, And what it's going to look like this week. We're going to see extreme volatility on a morning that we woke up to probably the hottest commodity run I've ever seen, and maybe in history. Nickel up 26% this morning, palladium up 14%, copper, lead, zinc, iron ore, gas, oil at 126. We've seen gold touching 2000. And so everything, precious metals, base metals, petroleum, everything is hitting on all cylinders. And let's face it, guys, not for the right reason, but and it's an unfortunate what the reason that it is hitting all this. We're in a crisis, and this crisis not over. It's far from over. It may just be starting, and I think we're in for a very, very bumpy ride for the next little while.
Okay. So. Yeah, bumpy ride. It's interesting, isn't it? So you think it'd take a little bit of time for things to find out where they want to go? I mean, at some point, something we'll have to give one way or the other. But do you think for the immediate term, it's going to be a little bit unsure and, as you say, a bit of a, like you say, bumpy ride?
Yeah, it is. And it is going to be risk off. I think anybody that has, an affinity for resources, They're going to be slightly active in resources and in gold. Investors will be opportunistic and we'll see some of that. But I think until we see a big rotation of capital leave sectors for a number of reasons, now we're seeing we're going to see it, you know, leave a jurisdiction, sadly, but we're going to see it leave, you know, inflation impacted asset classes, whereby, you know, some of, you know, consumer product goods, consumer discretionary, you know, telecommunications, consumer packaged goods, heavy industrials, some of those that are heavily impacted by inflation, we're going to see capital leave those asset classes and go somewhere. And the flight to safety has typically been gold, but we're also seeing, you know, we're also seeing flight to safety out of crypto and into other asset classes like gold. So I think, and gold ETFs. So I think we're going to see, while this bumpy ride goes on and while the risk off mentality, you know, stays with us for some time, we're going to see gold trade around these levels and up. And again, driven by headlines, you know, sadly.
Yeah, we were talking about this, Kenny, weren't we, before we actually started recording, about how does crypto fit into all of this? And I think that's anyone's guess really at the minute. I'm not sure where that's going to go. It's just, I guess it's the first time it's going through something like this, and it remains to be seen what happens to it.
Yeah, it's a strange one, because I mean, obviously I'm pretty heavily into crypto, so I do have a lot of physical silver. I have a tiny amount of gold, but it'd be quite a hard decision for me. If I had a spare $10,000, would I put it into crypto or would I put it into gold? I don't know. I know what you would do, Brett, but you've got to convince me to put my $10,000 into gold. Why?
Well, if you wanted to preserve that $10,000 and manage the risk down, I would put it in gold. If you wanted to be opportunistic and look for, you know, a volatile return, then you might put it in Bitcoin. I think the logical answer might be a little bit of both, but but you know, let's face it, Bitcoin's under 40,000. And you know, it's had a nice ride. Certainly the last 2 years has been very bumpy, down as low as under 30 and as high as close to 70. And we're down closer to the low. So is that a buying opportunity on the dip? I still really struggle with the fundamentals that drive the supply and demand of Bitcoin. When you layer that onto macroeconomic, geopolitical, geosocial, everything, all of the other risk factors, you know, I still struggle with why it trades, how it trades, in these types of dynamics. But if we're just looking at graphs, you know, Bitcoin is on the dip. And do you buy on the dip? Sure you do. So you might buy it. But again, when you layer on the geopolitical environment, it might be a bumpy ride.
Do you feel that Bitcoin is digital gold? I'm interested that you're not completely dismissing it. You obviously like it somewhat.
I think it's hard to dismiss it, because the total market cap of all cryptos, and obviously, you know, top 10 are probably going to be 90% plus of it, maybe more. The total market cap hit a peak of $3.5 trillion back. You know, I'm going to go back about July of last year, maybe August, September of last year. It hit its peak, and the entire mining sector in this world is $3 trillion of market cap. Now they're fluid. No, both of them are fluid. You know, crypto now is probably about 1.5, and mining's probably under 3. But you know, I think we're powering up now on natural resources, on mining stocks. I don't know whether we'll see that same powering up again. I really struggle with what is going to be kind of the driver for it. I think people like to have tangible, and again, this is a generational thing, and my son, his philosophy is quite different, and he's, you know, obviously he's in his 30s and I'm not. I think people like to have tangible physical things like real estate, like gold, to give them that comfort in volatile markets, in high inflationary markets, whereby they can actually take some comfort in that. Whereby those that same safe haven, that aren't those physical backed assets, that they tend to underperform in this type of market, and especially in high inflationary markets.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, if you'd said to me 2 years ago, you know, when I started buying silver, I was buying it more as because I liked it. You know, I'm a bit of a bug that way. But now that I've got, you know, 750 ounces or whatever I've got, I'm actually delighted I've got it because I know it's sitting there. And if I need to, you know, I can go and get that. I can go and sell that, you know, and it's an emergency fund. Sure. And when you sit and look at the portfolio getting smashed, there's nothing you can do about it. There's no liquidity. You can't get out. There's no exit route. But, you know, I've got this. It's almost like a comfort blanket that I just go to sleep with every night because I know it's there. So, yeah, I think a few people kind of raised a few eyebrows when they heard I was buying 1 kilogram bars of silver, etc. But no, I'm glad I've done it now, definitely.
Mm. I think you're going to see that here. You know, there's a store in London, right in Piccadilly, called Sharps Pixley, and they sell physical, and you can buy physical silver, physical gold, palladium. But I think you're right. People will sleep better at night because, you know, I don't think we've seen this degree of hostility globally, or in a, you know, obviously in a specific area, but we haven't seen this level of hostility. Or defense condition in the U.S. is probably at one of the highest defense conditions. They've been a DEFCON, you know, probably two. So they're probably at one of the highest ones they've been since the Second World War. So do I feel better having some gold in a box at home in my safe and some cash? And, you know, while the cash may not be worth much, but the gold's always going to be worth something. And for, you know, for 4,000 years, it's been worth something, and it's tangible, you know.
Definitely.
And with the prices of commodities then, do you think that's driven by supply-demand genuine concerns, or is it, as you say, headline-driven and it's almost a shock? What do you think?
Yeah, first of all, there is a shock, and there's a shock because of the headlines. And then there is, well, how does the current situation, you know, impact us in those commodities? Because let's face it, you know, Russia has gold, they have silver, they have nickel, they have a lot of precious, they have a lot of EV metals, they have a lot of base metals. And I think, you know, the world was trying to quickly calibrate, if this went on for some time, how does that affect the global supply? So that's one thing. And, you know, the antithesis to that is, does it impact the global demand from what they would consume in other areas? So that's going to you know, affect the prices of other things, and you know, probably more oil and gas than anything. But now we sit back and say, you know, what does this look like without Russia at the economic table? And I think the world's just, you know, over the last 48, 72, 96 hours have been trying to wrestle with that. And I think that's why we woke up this morning and we saw commodities and everything just take right off. And yes, there's some supply chain issues surrounding all of that, but I think it's just the world trying to calibrate, what does this mean? Because we're not done yet. And this is not over, and it's far from over. And everybody's trying to pontificate what the impact's going to be in Q2, Q3, Q4. Is there lagging consequences to this, and how is it going to impact all of these commodity prices? So, you know, the natural reaction for the market was scarcity, and you know, prices went up.
Yeah, and at some point, this has got to filter down to some of the juniors as well, because, you know, the markets in London, you're in London this week, Brett, I mean, they're absolutely getting smashed. There's no liquidity. There's some absolute bargains out there, so there is, you know, companies that are trading below cash, and you know, things like that. And I'm sure the TSX is dotted with hundreds of companies like that as well. At some point, it's got to come down to these guys. The liquidity has got to start flowing back in. It's just what moment triggers that, you know?
Yeah, you're right. I made the call last year, and I get it. It might have been a little self-serving because we had just started the company, and you know, I was trying to get some excitement around kind of what it is we were doing, and I said, you know, the gold sector and I saw it go from, you know, $25 to $750 in the 70s, and then in 2001 all the way up to kind of 2011, we saw it go from 250 240 all the way up to $1,921 on September 11th in 2011, where it peaked. So in that 10-year run, it went from like $200 to like $1,900. That's a tremendous bull market for gold.
Yep.
And each time, the floor of the gold price was reset. And I think the floor of the gold price is reset now again. In the 70s, that floor was around $400. In the 2000s, I think that floor went down to about $1,100. And I think that floor now is about $1,600 or $1,700. I don't think we're going to see, we may see volatility down that low, just like we're going to see volatility up, pushing up, you know, well into the 2000s. And I'm not a $5,000 gold guy, but you can understand why the dynamics, you know, you would support it. I just think, you know, the rational trading range for gold going forward is where it is today, $1,800 to $2,200. And I would have thought gold would have traded even higher over the last week or two. And maybe it trades higher going forward, but it hasn't. And last year, I told the market, I said, you know what? I didn't get it wrong. I got the timing wrong. So I saw the train coming at us down the tracks, and this was the whole inflationary environment where with the U.S. carrying $30 trillion of debt and $3 trillion of deficit they run every year, I said, that's not sustainable. The quantitative easing, the continued printing of money, and then the bond market, the long bond market we see, the 10-year market right now, 1.8 in a 7% inflationary environment is like a minus 4 or 5% real rate of return. People are not going to stay in that market very long if they're going to see prolonged inflation like this. Now, yes, increasing interest rates is supposed to offset that, but I think 0.25% increase in interest rates is not changing the behaviors. People are still leveraging themselves. Now, they may be a little more cautious given the events of today, but it's simply not going to change things. But during that whole time, all last year and into this year, we did not see anything flow back into kind of the junior mining space, to your point. And the majors actually were trading at fairly low multiples. Like they were trading, typically they trade at kind of seven times cash flow, and some of them went down as low as 2x cash flow. And Barrick and Newmont are a good example of that. They were trading at extremely low multiples, whether it price to cash flow or price to earnings. They were trading at very low multiples. Now they're starting to recover, but our market, the junior space, hasn't started to see that yet. So yes, it does take time. We've seen a couple of cycles like this. It will come back. It will start to flow down because the speculation is that the pipeline that the operators have isn't large enough to replace reserves in the gold space or reserves in the base metal space, and we will start to see some of that capital come down. And to my other point about sector rotation of capital, there's so much money that is going to come out of these impacted asset classes that if they want exposure, they're not just going to buy the majors and mid-tiers. They're going to buy all of the exposure. They're going to have risk-adjusted returns on the bottom end, and they're going to have the majors on top.
Yeah, it's a topic we could talk about all day. Mm. Brett, and I know Mark loves it as well, but
we need to talk about the company, don't we, at some point?
Yeah. We'll leave that behind and we can maybe get you back on another day, Brett, and we can talk at length about gold and all these. It's almost like back-to-back black swan events we've had with COVID and now what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. So it's uncharted territory. So there'll be plenty of opinions and going forward and what's going to happen. But I think, it'd be good to talk about Goldshore. Maybe if you can sort of give us a high level overview of the company, Brett, and then we can sort of drill down into obviously your flagship property, Moss Lake.
Yeah, we acquired the Moss Lake project from Wesdome Gold Mines last January in 2021. For a headline number of $52 million, 12.5 of that was in cash, and the balance was in shares. and share-based payments over some milestones over 4 or 5 years. And I ended up putting together, you know, I always say projects are all about people at the end of the day. And we have one of the, I'll say one of the strongest management teams, boards, and advisory boards that you'll see on any junior mining company and in pre-production. We have a whole team of CEOs who have tremendous track records, and some have run majors, some have run, you know, mid-tiers like myself, and everyone knows when they see value and they want to get involved in this project, so they see value. But we have, our project is in northwestern Ontario, again, tier one jurisdiction, low risk, probably in the safest mining jurisdiction in the world. And we're starting with a 4 million ounce historical resource. And the deposit, the historical resource covers about 2.5 kilometers of a 20 kilometer known mineralized trend. So we have a really strong starting point here with very little geological risk. And what we're trying to do is risk de-risk it in other areas as we get through our 100,000 meter program. And then at the end of it, we will update our mineral resource statement to see if we've achieved that tier one asset status. And then we will get through a new preliminary economic assessment, or a PEA, because there's been one done back in 2013 that was updated by Westome in 2020. And the economics we're starting with, before we add any ounces to it at all, are pretty impressive, pretty stellar. And you know, the NPV of this deposit as it sits today, updated in 2020, is around $600 million post-tax at $1,700 gold. And it sensitizes about $120 million increase in NPV post-tax every $100 of the gold price. So today at $2,000 gold, you can add $400 million onto the NPV of that, which is almost $1 billion now. And companies like ours, they trade at about 0.3 times NPV. So if you took today's gold price, and I'll be aggressive here, take today's gold price of $2,000 times 0.3, it's around a $300 million market cap. But our market cap today is 58 million. So there's a lot of scope for our project to get into the spotlight, for value to be realized by shareholders as the market starts to calibrate Goldshore to its existing economics. And that's before we spend any time, money, energy, and add any ounces to this. This is just the existing project we know. And so I think this is a great entry, a great opportunity for people to get into the stock. And then, you know, another valuation metric is quite simple. How do you trade to your peers if you've got a like for like comparison? And the bank has put together a group of about 12 like for like, you know, projects at the same level of development, same risk profile, and same size, roughly the same size of deposits. And we're trading not at our mean. The mean of our group is trading around $45 an ounce. We're trading at $14 an ounce this morning. So we're trading at a third of our peer group mean. We're not in the fourth quartile. We're the bottom of the pack. And I attribute those two things to the fact that the market has just not cared about gold. When I made the call last year that we were going to see, you know, gold start to perform, gold equity start to perform, it hasn't happened because inflation really never kind of caught up until Q4 and Q1 of this year. And, you know, that sector rotation, I think, was tempered by the activities that have been going on in Ukraine. So I think, you know, there's a day of reckoning for not just us, but gold equities and juniors who are extremely undervalued to the cost of exploration. I think we'll see our day. It's just going to take that sector rotation of capital to come find us.
Mm. Yep. And obviously, before we talk about Ontario, because we know that's a fantastic province to be mining in, have you guys got skin in the game? I mean, that's always a big tick, you know, for any investor. You know, what have these guys put into, you know, the project? How much of the hard-earned cash have they parted with?
Yeah, so at the end of the day, if we do another financing, which we will, and, you know, I don't try and hide these things, it's pretty simple math. People want to know how much money we have and how much money we need to spend to get through our program. That's pretty simple. I'll probably have close to $1 million into this myself personally, as will several of our board members and our advisory board. We insiders, so management board, advisory board, deemed insiders, own 25% of this company. And we were the ones that took the early risk. We're the ones that took the, you know, fed into the IPO. We're the ones that participated in November of this past year, and will participate in the next one, because, you know, this is not a project that's going to die in the vine. This could go into production tomorrow. So the downside risk of this project, I think, is quite limited, like very little. But the upside risk is, as I've just described, quite compelling. When we're trading at 1/3 our economics, or 1/6 our economics to $2,000 gold, or trading as we are to our peer group, and that's our starting point before we even get through our program, there is going to be some really, really happy shareholders in a year's time.
Yep. And obviously, Mark, you know quite a bit about the area because you've interviewed quite a few CEOs that have got projects in Ontario.
Yeah, yes, indeed. It's an area that seems to be pretty underexplored, dotted with activity, and it's a huge area as well. Just so I understand, your project is Moss Lake.
Yeah.
And this is a project, it's got a lot of historical data as well, you say?
It does. So Moss Lake was drilled out by the Moss Lake gold mines back in the 80s and 90s, and they would raise a bit of money and then they would stop. And the gold price, it's all driven by the gold price and what the capital markets were doing at the time. Wesdome earned into it in 2014, and in 2016 owned all of it. And they took Moss Lake right out of the picture. And subsequent to that timeline, they bolted on two projects, both Hamlin Lake and Coldstream. And Coldstream was a historic copper gold mine that was run by Xstrata in the 80s, shut down in 92 just because of the copper price. And so we have some interesting targets there as well. Moss Lake has had about 110,000 meters drilled on it historically. And that's where our focus is for the first kind of 6 months of this program. But there's also been around 40,000 meters drilled at Coldstream, and about 6,000 meters drilled even further on at a target called Iris Lake, and about 10,000 meters drilled at Hamlin. And these are all, the drilling programs all have mineralization. Like, we're talking commercial mineralization. You can certainly see it on our presentation on our website, but these are very, very interesting targets. And we're going to be multi-element assaying these for copper, gold, silver, but copper, lead, zinc, moly as well, because the styles of deposits up at Coldstream appear to be more VMS style and IOCG down in Hamlin, whereas Moss Lake is a disseminated gold project. It's a shear zone hosted and a very disseminated, low grade, bulk tonnage, very, very, I'll say, uncomplex.
How old is Goldshore, the company? When did you pick this project up?
We did the deal with Wesdome in January of 2021.
Okay.
We raised $25 million in February of 21. And then those two transactions got put in abeyance for approval by the TSX. And because of COVID, they were delayed. We got approval on May 31st, and we were admitted for trading on June the 4th of last year.
Okay. Yeah. So it's relatively new, but it's got a lot of historical data. Is there some copper amongst the mix as well?
There sure is. And down at Hamlin, we've got a lot of hits with copper gold around, 0.9 grams per ton and 0.35% copper over, 150, 160 meters. So meaningful intercepts.
Okay. And am I right in understanding as well that you, I don't know if it's the right phrase, twinned some holes, and the numbers on them were pretty close?
We did. And the early stage of the program, we've been, verifying kind of the existing historical resource so we can get enough new data to verify it and bring it up into a current resource when we go to do our resource estimate update. But and some surprises too. We just put out a hole last week, which had some significant mineralization. And here's the odd the state of affairs with the market. We put out a press release that had almost 60 meters of 6 gram material, and the overhaul, the whole hole was just under a gram for 274 meters. And this is in an area that's on the very edge of the existing resource. So one could say, okay, there's resource extensions over on that side of the resource. That's great. Exceptional hole. You know, probably one of the best that's come out so far this year in our space, not just, you know, not just in the area. And our share price went down 2 cents. So there's no rhyme or reason right now as to the market, you know, how the market's reacting to some of this stuff. I don't lose sleep at night over this. I try not to, because the market will eventually figure it out. You know, markets are efficient. People figure these things out. And then it's like, oh God, geez, gold short. They're so undervalued. And, you know, they're getting good results. It's not like, you know, they're not getting good results. And this is real. So when it happens, yeah, it'll accelerate. I get it. But it hasn't happened yet. And there's been a lot of, say, turbulence in the market over the last 2 months for all the other things going on, not just our performance.
Yeah, I mean, we see that in London, don't we, Kenny? Company releases what looks like a fantastic piece of news, yeah. and the market just doesn't react the way you expect it to. But at some point, yeah, the market will recognize it when perhaps the love goes into the exploration side of things and away from maybe tech or crypto or something, I don't know. But yeah, I feel your frustrations with that as well. And are you, so at the stage you're at now then, you have a PEA from previous historical work, and you're working to update that throughout the latter half of this year?
We are. So the 100,000 meter program we'll do first. We'll update the resource statement with the results. So hopefully taking 4 million ounces to, you know, upwards of, you know, closer to 10, and then we'll do, yeah, update the PEA. It's more like we're going to redo the PEA. We're going to do a brand new one, because I think all the input parameters of the existing PEA are going to be, by default, they're going to be, you know, unusable. You know, the size of the project that we're going to, you know, scope is going to be much bigger than the size of the project with the inputs they used last time.
Okay. Go on. Yep, Mark, I think it'd be good maybe to put Brett in the spot with our 60-second challenge. I'll maybe let you explain it to Brett as a good way to finish off.
We can certainly do that, yes. We can give you 60 seconds, Brett, to kind of make the elevator pitch for the company. I think it would be quite good, seeing as, as you say, it's a relatively new company. The market cap is at 54 Canadian, so what's that in pounds, Kenny? 25?
About 30 million.
£30 million, yeah. So, yep. You know, there's certainly lower end of the market, so value to certainly be had. So, I mean, would you be up for that if I was to start a stopwatch and just give you sort of 60 seconds?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, in that case, then in 3, 2, 1, take it away.
Thanks. You know, Gold Shore Resources, the investment thesis on Gold Shore Resources is quite simple. We have a historical resource that is, you know, 4 million ounces that we have put together a program that's well-financed, that's driven by, you know, one of the best management teams, technical teams, and boards that we'll see in our space, driven to success. And the success of this project will be getting through our program, updating our resource statement, and then putting together a new PEA so that we can demonstrate to the market the value that not only we have, the value we're going to create, and the value we're going to land at. Because today, we're trading at anywhere from 1/3 to 1/6 our potential in these valuation metrics that are typical in our marketplace. And when I look at the potential going forward, there is substantial share price upside to investors who come in today and follow the story and stay with the story until we are able to give our shareholders an off-ramp or a liquidity event somewhere down the future. So we tick a lot of boxes: people, jurisdiction, deposit, quality, optionality with our copper and copper gold targets, and we have tremendous and compelling economics that we're starting with. So that's the Gold Shore opportunity.
Excellent. Well, that was nice. It's 1:19, but a very nice synopsis of the company for sure. So thank you very much for that. That's really introduced me to this company that I didn't really know a lot about before we started this podcast. And nice to talk there also about gold and commodities. And it'd be nice to catch up with you again, Brett. Maybe we can do a special on commodities and mining stocks. And of course, we can catch up again when as and when things develop on with Goldshore as well. Kenny, do you have any other questions?
No. It's been really, really good. That's about sort of 50 minutes. Like I say, we could have spent a lot more time talking about gold, but I think we've got a nice balance. You know, we've got your history, Brett, your mining career, and obviously we've got the company, and then we've got your knowledge on the commodities and gold. So it was a good balance for the first podcast. So I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on today, Brett.
Yeah, Kenny and Mark, I appreciate you guys having me on the show. I'd love to do this again sometime, and you know, hopefully the circumstances from a global standpoint will be better. But you know, this works in many environments and gold price environments. So look forward to having another discussion with you guys later on. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much, Brett.
Cheers. That was brilliant.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.